Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Sue Vizakis, and we are going to be discussing Shadow Over Mars by Lee Brackett, which was awarded the 2020 Retro Hugo for Best Novel for the publication year. Well, I guess the publication year was 1944, but the Hugo year was 1945. So, hi there, Sue. Thanks for joining me.
I'm so happy to be here.
It's wonderful to have you, and I want to talk a little bit about you because I think you have an interesting job that people might like to hear about. So tell my listeners about yourself.
Okay. My job is fascinating. It's the most fun gig in the world. I'm a librarian at Johns Hopkins University. I work with the public health and engineering, some of the engineering departments mostly, and it's just enormous fun. Here's why I went into librarianship, because in college I was interested in everything. And if you become a librarian, you don't have to, as they say, pick a major. Mm. So really at a library, you can do everything. Even though I'm in science and engineering, I pretty much get to do a little bit of everything and do whatever I want. We have a lot of autonomy here. It's great fun. And the other thing is, professors have to deal with grades and exams. Librarians don't. We only get to do the fun things, like working with the students and hearing about projects and going to seminars about robotics and AI. And I hope this means that I've just convinced most of your listeners to go to get a master's degree from a school of information science, which is required by professional librarians.
Nice. And so what is your interaction with students?
Oh, everything you can imagine. Students send me questions, hey, I can't get into this article, to, hey, I need to learn how to use RefWorks, or what database should I use to find this or that, or my topic is X, help. In the engineering school here at Johns Hopkins, most of the engineering departments, there are nine, have design teams of some sort or another. So design teams will say, hey, Sue, our project is X. Can we talk to you? So we either have a Zoom meeting, or they come and we all sit in a seminar room. They tell me what kind of medical device they're trying to invent. And we talk about finding information.
Nice.
Yeah.
One of my senior design projects with a group design project was it was medical related. So
very
that's
cool.
Kind of fun. Yeah.
I hope you asked your librarian for help.
It was a smaller school.
You complete the fifth on that. It's okay. It's
yeah. It was a smaller school. The librarian was typically just our professor.
Ah.
So, or just going to the actual library. Cool. Well, so then what about your history as a science fiction fan?
Oh, goodness. I am, absolutely, I have a massive nerdy history with science fiction. Both my parents were bookies, and I was always, always a reader. My mom always read to me. Whenever we moved, the first thing she did was take us to the public library to get a card. I always loved stories about everything, as long as they were imaginary. I'm not a nonfiction fan, unfortunately. My dad was the real science fiction influencer, though. He was an organic chemist. The publications he got in the mail were Chemical and Engineering News, the Federal Register, and Fantasy and Science Fiction. He always devoured sci-fi as a kid, was even in a book club with Hal Clement for a while. Some of Dad's favorites were the Gray Lensman series by E.E. Doc Smith, Everything Tarzan, the Foundation series, and H.P. Lovecraft, who, despite being a pretty despicable human person, was an amazing storyteller. I still do try to use the words Eldritch and Batrachian in conversation, although they're a little hard to work in. Then came Star Trek, the original series. I basically had memorized the entire series, all the albums by Leonard Nimoy, and drove everyone crazy by constantly talking about Star Trek, which has not changed, Seth. This has not changed. But reading was always my thing. I loved incredible stories like everyone who ever lived on Earth all waking up next to an endless river in the Riverworld saga, or about creatures like puppeteers and Kazin, and strange goings on at CERN that may have affected the whole world. Robert J. Sawyer is one of my faves.
Oh, flash forward.
I've been to CERN. Yes, I've been to CERN, by the way. It creeped me out just a little having read the story before then. Actually, my band went to play in the Montreux Jazz Festival in 2008. And so I wrote to the CERN librarian and said, hi, I'm the physics librarian at Hopkins. Can I come see CERN? So I get to see it. Way cool.
That's awesome.
And by the way, I'm stunned that Light from Uncommon Stars didn't win last year's Hugo. I hope I'm allowed to say that. I also do like post-apocalyptic stories, like our friend author, the author and podcaster, Dan Smith. It's all about great stories.
Yeah. My dad was also an organic chemist.
Really?
Yeah.
That's cool.
He taught for 38 years at the University of Alaska Anchorage.
Wonderful.
Yep. And he worked for DuPont before that, when he was doing postgraduate work.
Neat. So. My dad was a professor at Temple first and then went to Johnson & Johnson.
Okay. Did you happen to tally up how many Hugo winners you'd read?
Why, yes, I did, Seth. 20. Right. 20. With some partials, including Neuromancer. I do want to read the Broken Earth trilogy, and I'm happy to report that I've finally started the universally loved Murderbot series and am greatly enjoying it.
Yes. Yeah. My Take Me to Your Reader co-host Colin and I recently got James to read those.
Oh, good.
And he's loving those. So
I do also love that podcast. It's huge fun.
Oh, great. I'm glad to hear it. So I am sitting at 77 Hugo winners read. I only have two left. So
wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I hope when you're done, there will be cake.
Yes, perhaps. Or the cake could be a lie. So is that what you were referencing, by the way?
No, that I hope that you'll have a big giant cake served to you when you are done reading all of them.
Okay. Sorry. I thought you were making a Portal reference. So not a gamer?
Not this time. Not really. No.
Okay.
Except for, I'll mention D&D briefly. Several years ago, I proclaimed myself the unofficial science fiction librarian of Johns Hopkins University. This was mostly just to impress the science fiction club here, which has existed since the early 1970s. And Roger Zelazny was a member for a while when non-affils were allowed to join.
Awesome.
But my D&D character description gave me better street cred than being the librarian. She was greedy and cowardly and had a ring of invisibility. And once I told them about her, they thought, oh, cool. So there you have it.
Very nice. Well, on the topic of only having two of these left, I normally ask, you know, why this book? And at this point, it's a lot of, well, there weren't many books left, Seth, and you pretty much asked me to cover this one. But you did specifically request this one out of the remaining titles.
I did. I have three reasons, Seth.
Okay.
Reason one, it has a female author, Lee Brackett, as you mentioned, which was unusual at that time. Mm-hmm. Two, long ago, I was captivated by one of her short stories and never forgot her name, but no, I can't find it again, which is a drag. Oh. And three, because it was written in 1944, during the war years, World War II affected the publishing industry along with everything else. And I'd like to talk about that just a little bit, if I may, but I promise I won't be boring. I do have a little background about info about Brackett and about World War II. Librarian thing, we always have information. Would it be better to hear one or both of those now or later?
Let's see. I think it makes sense to talk. I think you also said you wanted to talk about the retro Hugos.
Why, yes, that fits into all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Go for it.
Okay. All right. First, a little Brackett bio. She was born in 1915 and died in 1978 at age 62, unfortunately. She was best known for fantasy and science fiction, but also wrote really good detective novels and 16 film and television scenarios. Mm-hmm. She started out by reading Edgar Rice Burroughs and H. Rider Haggard, and then wanted to write her own. She started publishing science fiction stories in 1940 with Martian Quest for Astounding, one of my fave mags, and my dad's too. And most of the 40 or so stories she published in her first decade as a professional writer were collected in two collections. The second one was called Lorelei of the Red Mist, Planetary Romances. Now, that story, Lorelei of the Red Mist, which was written in 1946, was written in collaboration with Ray Bradbury. She and Bradbury were great friends, and he was the best man at her wedding. Did you know that?
Yeah.
Okay. I'm sure you, of course you did. What kind of a fool am I even asking?
I don't do a ton of research, but I did read Lee Brackett's Wikipedia article today.
And, oh, excellent. Wikipedia. Okay, moving on. You can read this story for free on Project Gutenberg, by the way, and I have a million references, and I will send you all of them for your show notes. Most of her work appeared in Planet Stories, Thrilling Wonder Stories, and others that offered space for what became her specialty, which, quote, was swashbuckling but literate planetary romances, usually set on Mars. A non-series novels set on Mars were this one, Shadow Over Mars, and the best-known Sword of Rhiannon, 1949, which was in Thrilling Wonder Stories. She also did have other well-known Mars-based stories, mostly about a character called Eric John Stark, starting in 1949. Then in the 70s, she wrote more Stark stories that were collected. But then she started focusing on space operas. The best one was The Long Tomorrow, 1955, and that was a best novel finalist for the 56 Hugo Awards. And she was the first female novelist to be recognized with being elected for or nominated for a Hugo. Now, 1956, this, of course, occurred before her retro Hugo, which was awarded in 2020, as you said, but which was written in 44. Yeah. And after the mid-50s, she worked mostly in cinema and television, including screenplays for The Long Goodbye in 1973, and for film director Howard Hawks' The Big Sleep and Rio Bravo. And there's a great story about Howard Hawks. Apparently, he liked her first novel, which was a detective thriller, and told his secretary to, quote, locate this guy Brackett to write screenplays for him. And he was not dismayed when Brackett turned out to be a woman. So that was good. Now, your listeners may know this too. Her last film work was a draft for Star Wars Episode V, The Empire Strikes Back, in 1980. And she did receive a posthumous 1981 Hugo for that, for Best Dramatic Presentation. Finally, she was inducted into the Science Fiction Hall of Fame in 2014. And if there are any Halloween fans out there, you may recognize that the character of Sheriff Lee Brackett was named after her. And many writers acknowledged her influence on them. She was much more influential on the world of science fiction than I ever knew, including Harlan Ellison, Marion Zimmer Bradley, Philip Jose Farmer, Tanith Lee, Gene Wolfe, and of course, Ray Bradbury. So that's that. Now, what is a retro Hugo, your listeners may be asking? They're probably not, because they all know this stuff, but I'll just... Librarian, I'm just going to give a little info.
Sounds good. And by the way, I did appreciate the way you looked down your nose when I said Wikipedia.
I'm librarian glad. Things. I'm glad. The Hugo Awards are given, of course, by the World Science Fiction Society at their World Cons. World Cons began in 1939, still going on, of course, missing only the World War II years of 1942 through 45, because no World Cons were held at all. Hugos themselves, though, started in 53, missed 54, and have been awarded every year then since 55. So in 1996, retrospective Hugo Awards were added. And these are awarded during World Cons that are held 50 years, 75 years, or 100 years after a year when no Hugos were awarded for whatever reason. So what years get retro Hugos? If I figured it out right, the years since World Cons began in 1939 that did not award Hugos were 39, 40, 41, 1946 through 52, and 1954, that year after the awards began that was skipped. That makes a total of 11 Hugo-less years. As of 2022, 8 of those years have had retro Hugos awarded. And Seth, here is a news flash for you and your listeners. The next opportunity to award a retro would be this year, but the official Hugo Award page says no retros will be awarded this year. So there you have it. So as you know, Lee Brackett's award for this year was awarded in 2020. So that was 75 years later. Now, it was first published, Shadow Over Mars again was the original title, in Startling Stories in 1944. This was the complete novel. However, in 1951, it was retitled to The Nemesis from Terra for one of the Ace double paperbacks, and it was published, the double, with Collision Course by Robert Silverberg. What is an Ace double, your listeners may be asking? You're they're never going to want you to invite a librarian again. So Ace Doubles started with mainstream mystery and Western stories. The Sci-Fi Doubles ran for 21 years. And I did enjoy reading this bit. The double format inspired contests for ironic or satirical combinations of titles that might appear, as in No Blade of Grass with The Sheep Look Up. Mm. Now, those are two real book titles. Right. This was just fun. Wikipedia may have a list of Ace Double titles for this kind of thing. I don't care. Wiki is a fine source for other things. Moving on. And one more thing is that Brackett also won a Retro Hugo that same year, that is 2020, for Best Related Work. That happened to be an essay called The Science Fiction Field. Mm. I was not able to find it online, but I'm sure it's fascinating. The essay was published in Writer's Digest in July 1944, and Writer's Digest, by the way, started in 1920 and still published today. Mm. So that's the Retro Hugo info.
Nice. I will say that I'm holding out for the 1952 Retro Hugos, where The Day of the Triffids will be eligible.
To me,
is the obvious winner. So,
actually, Day of the Triffids has a tie-in to today for me, which is Earth Day.
Okay.
Let me bore you quickly with the tie-in. Mm. When I was in 7th grade, 8th grade, it was reading period in English, and I was reading Day of the Triffids. Mm. And there was an announcement saying, today is the first Earth Day. Everyone should write something about Earth Day. And I thought, I don't want to do that. I'm reading this great story about these giant plants. So I whipped off a quick poem, and I won the prize for my grade, and I won $10.
Nice.
Hey, all right. Sorry. Diversion.
That's great.
But yeah, Triffids is great. And Howard Keel was in the movie, and he was awesome.
So you mentioned, Sue, that this novel was published during World War II, and that what effect World War II had kind of on the publishing industry. You want to talk about that?
Yes, absolutely. In my collection of pulp science fiction magazines that I have from my father, I have issues of Astounding Stories in three different sizes in 1 year. That year was 1943, and the reason was the paper shortage, which was quite acute everywhere.
Right.
From January 1942 through April of 43, it was letter size. It was pulp size, again, restored to a bigger size, from May 43 through October 43, but then it went down to digest size in November of 43. And stayed that way for the next 20 years. Mm. So three different sizes. And it also was the first digest size science fiction magazine. As I said, the paper shortages were very acute. And by the way, this article from whence this information came in sciencefictionencyclopedia.com, which is awesome, a great reference, also said that the paper shortage actually killed off Unknown, which was one of my dad's favorite mags too, but paper shortage did away with it. Too bad. There's a lot of info about what happened to the publishing industry during the paper shortage, but have you, Seth, ever heard of Armed Services Editions?
I have. Yeah.
Okay. Excellent.
I know there was stuff, particularly with comic books, that were in Armed Service Editions.
Oh,
go ahead.
That I did not know. I only knew about the novels, I think. The story about Armed Services Editions is told in a really amazing book called When Books Went to War, and I'll, of course, send you the ref. I will tell it very briefly. It became known that soldiers overseas had very low morale. Mm. Times were tough. They had nothing to do on their off hours. It was just really very difficult. A bunch of things happened, which I'll skip, and the American Library Association, which still is going strong today, formed the National Defense Book Campaign. And we realized that we needed to supply servicemen who were overseas with books. But how? With a paper shortage. In 1943, publishers were only allowed to use about a third of the paper that they'd had a few years ago. But the government said, quote, books were necessary equipment, and agreed to give hundreds of tons of paper for the production of Armed Services Editions. Mm. These were called ASEs, and they were produced especially to fit into soldiers' pockets, the uniform pockets. They were small with thin pages and completely readable under all conditions, even though there were more words on the page than regular books. And my last point is this was just incredibly successful. The authors of the books that were chosen to be printed in this format got countless letters from grateful servicemen about how much their books had meant. Now, just for fun, I looked at the list of books that were chosen to see which ones fell into our field. So here are a few that were made into armed services editions and sent to the soldiers in World War II. Dracula, Frankenstein, When Worlds Collide, The Time Machine, The Dunwich Horror and Other Tales, Donovan's Brain for some reason. Who chose that? I don't know. War of the Worlds, Adventures of Superman, Island of Dr. Moreau, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, and Tarzan of the Apes. So that's just an extremely interesting part of World War II history that I wanted to pass along.
Yeah. Yeah,
Thank you for indulging me the time.
When I was talking about the comic books and that, I knew about the Adventures of Superman. Cool. That's really interesting because you think of the pulp era in science fiction as being, you know, printed on cheap, you know, not very nice paper, and being sort of throwaway stuff. But then what happens when you don't have paper? That's fascinating.
Yeah.
So Sue, how about a quick non-spoiler synopsis of this?
Got it. Okay. Mars is a mess. Humans and Martians don't get along. The government is a bunch of helpless wimps. And the company, which basically controls most of the humans on Mars, sends out its creatures to capture men and force them to work in the company's mines. The number two guy at the company is a murderous thug called Jaffa Storm. As the story opens, our hero, Rick, is being chased by the creatures and ducks into a doorway. An ancient Martian woman and her grandson live there. She, quote, sees Rick's shadow over Mars, tries to knife him, and Rick kills her. So things are happening already. He does get captured by the company's creatures, but later escapes from the mines along with a beautiful spy who was there spying. Her name is Mayo McCall. Then Rick and Mayo are both captured by Martians, including the Martian's boy king. The grandson from earlier insists that Rick be punished for murdering his grandmother. Jaffa Storm has murdered his way to the top of the company, and he and his Venusian gang break into this group of the Martians and capture Mayo McCall. And I will stop there.
Okay. And it's a very bad couple of weeks for Rick.
Absolutely. Well put.
Yeah. On the other hand, he survives it quite well. I mean, he survives a lot of stuff that you would think, oh, this is the end for him.
Yep.
And I'm curious, with the publication history of this one, was it published in full novel form first or was it serialized?
Surprisingly, it was in full novel form the first time.
Okay. Because I wondered about any time there's sort of episodic things in a story where, you know, hero gets in peril, hero escapes peril. Mm-hmm. I always wonder if, you know, those cycles are being repeated in serialization, but it doesn't sound like that. Mm-hmm. So comps for this novel, anything similar to it that you would want to recommend?
Yes. Because Lee Brackett really loved Edgar Rice Burroughs' stuff. John Carter's stories, because there are certainly similarities with Rick, I would suggest, as well as Brackett's own character of Eric John Stark. Again, hard-bitten, tough underdog loner kind of thing. And one of the writers somewhere also described Rick, our hero in this story, as somewhat feral, like Mowgli or Tarzan. I don't think Mowgli really fits the bill, but Tarzan certainly does. So any Edgar Rice Burroughs and also Eric John Stark, I would suggest.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely had The Princess of Mars. That's the only one in the series that I've read, but it has a similar feel to it, right? This falls under the category of planetary romance.
Yeah.
It very much is that. It's in that the spirit, I think, of Burroughs.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So overall thoughts on this one. What did you think of the novel?
It was very linear.
Yes.
Stuff happened, stuff happened again, and stuff kept happening. I think that when you read older stories and see older movies, the writing or acting style can be distracting, not because it's bad, but just because we're not used to it.
Yes.
So the happily brief descriptions of how women look in their coveralls, boy, did I get tired of seeing the word coverall, and some of Rick's turns of phrase, like, sure, if that's the way you want to play it, and by golly, why not? might take one out of the story just momentarily. Now, that's not a comment on her writing. It's just how language and style evolve.
Yeah.
Probably anyone who reads things or watches things from this era all the time, it wouldn't really have much of an effect on them.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it was not completely to my taste, but I really think Lee Brackett is so awesome that I don't mind.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a little bit of a hard time getting into this one. It's definitely one of those stories that just sort of has a situation going on, drops you into the middle of it, and you have to catch up. And there's not a lot of sort of explanation of what is the current situation here. There's no, as you were aware, Bill, talking about the political situation on Mars or anything. It's just Rick was in trouble. Rick was running from someone for some reason. And then it, you know, through the plot, it kind of reveals what's going on. But it took me a while to kind of get the thread of why am I rooting for this guy? What's he trying to do? Why is he constantly being exiled or tortured or executed? But overall, you know, kind of once I got into it, and I think it's a good point that you made about reading something from this era, you do kind of have to put yourself into that mindset and enjoy the adventure. And, and so ultimately, I did enjoy it.
And you make a good point about being dropped right into the action. There's big talk in the world building podcasts and discussions that I listen to about how some people really want to be dropped into the action. They don't want a lot of exposition. They don't want to hear how the physics of the planet works. They don't want to hear who anybody is. Just go. And then for others, possibly me, no comment. I need a little bit, or okay, yes, it's me. I need a little bit more explanation, or I appreciate it, not needed, but I appreciate a little bit more explanation. But I can hang on if I'm dumped into the action, because I am a professional science fiction reader and appreciator. So I was able to hang on until enough stuff happened that I could figure it out. But yes, you're right. It was kind of like holding onto a bucking bronco in the beginning.
Mm-hmm. And I have to say, too, that the older view, you know, the kind of pre-space exploration view of what Mars might be like is very charming to me.
Yes.
And honestly, I feel like space exploration has just been a big party pooper because there were so many cool things happening on Mars in fiction. And nope, not so much.
Yeah, I have to agree with that. There was a gentleman here at Hopkins. We recently lost him at age 93, 94, who actually discovered life on Mars, Dr. Wow. Gilbert Levin. Now, but you were talking about cool things. When people like us think of life on Mars, we're not thinking about a bacterium. Mm-hmm. And that's so. Yeah, that I understand. I think party pooper is a fine phrase for it. Yeah, yeah. Which is why, actually, I read that Brackett, when she started up with more stories in the 70s with for Eric John Stark, they were no longer on Mars, but they were interstellar, because Mars and Venus had sort of been disqualified as interesting places for stories.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you do have quite a bit of the retro Mars in the Hugo Awards. I mean, just Stranger in a Strange Land is another one.
Ugh, that is one of the 20 I read.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm rolling my eyes.
It's certainly an interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
There, one thing that I feel like Brackett does really well here is the way the characters are named. And this is not always the case. Sometimes I have a hard time keeping track of who is who because the character names are too similar. And here you have, you know, Law the Dwarf and Fallon the Company Man and Jaffa Storm, such a great name.
Yeah.
Budok, the warrior, kind of the general, Hugh St. John and Aaron Mack.
Mm-hmm.
They're just great evocative names. And, for such a short book, I was very impressed with how easy it was to keep track of all those characters, even though there are a lot of them.
That's a very good point. I didn't have to make a chart as I do for some of the novels that I read in my various book clubs.
Yeah.
I was not, it was not necessary for me to make a chart. You could follow the names. Definitely an excellent point.
Yeah. I did want to find out. So the main character's name is Richard Gunn Urquhart.
Yes.
And have you ever seen Enemy Mine?
The Dennis Quaid? Sure. Dennis Quaid
Louis Gossett Jr.
Yes. They were both excellent. I loved it. One of my faves.
And he calls, Louis Gossett Jr.'s character calls him Urkman. That's the way he says Earthman. And I was just like, was that a reference to Lee Brackett? Because that would be hilarious. But I have no knowledge of that. I just wondered about it.
A very subtle connection. I have no knowledge of that either, but I like to think it's true.
I also like that the company is called the Terran Exploitations Company.
Just
make no bones about the fact that this is the big evil enemy.
Right. But it was supposed to be, what they were making, not only were they controlling people to get into the mines, but they were making something, I can't find it in my notes now, that was supposed to be better than plastic. So it was supposed to be a really great product that was supposed to help Earthers.
Right. By exploiting Mars.
By exploiting Mars. Yeah. Exactly.
Let's see.
I'm trying to stay away from spoilers.
Yeah, I think you know, we with the preamble about the Retro Hugos and that kind of stuff, I feel like people might be impatient for us to go ahead and get into spoilers. It sounds like we both at least enjoyed parts of it. Mm-hmm. And it's very much a 1940s book that reads like a 1940s book.
Yeah.
It's quite brief.
Yes.
I think less than 150 pages.
Yes, that would be, looking at my copy, exactly 150.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And you got a nice paperback version of it?
I did. Okay. I'm holding it up so you can see it at least.
Yes. Yeah. It is not the easiest book to come by.
Nope. I had to buy it used.
I have to buy it used. I did manage to find it on ebook, and if I can find the reference for it, because I looked for it the other day and couldn't find it. I thought, did I get one before it was taken down? It's not a great ebook. Lots of typographic errors, which is typical of when a book is turned from paperback using OCR into an ebook.
Yes. Yeah.
Lots of little misspellings that you kind of have to go, I think that meant something different, but it's fine.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So why don't we go ahead and jump over to spoilers, Sue?
Okay. My goodness. Well, I did appreciate the fact that Rick did not end up taking over Mars.
So you're going straight to the big spoiler.
Straight for the big spoiler. It's just, yeah. Do you want to talk about some of the smaller ones first?
No. I think that's an excellent place to start, actually.
Okay. It does have to do partly with his personality, and this is partly 1940s stuff. So he and Mayo are in one of their discussions, and Mayo says, "I love you, Rick, but X and Y and Z."
Yes.
And this time she says, this is right after he says, "By golly, why not? Maybe I can take over Mars and make it better, or use it, or do whatever." She instantly changes her mind about the fact that maybe he wouldn't be such a good, that is, she changes her mind and says, "No, there's no love in you, and you'll bring death and destruction." So that was an instant after saying, "Oh, I love you, and you'd be a great leader." And then he replies, "If that isn't just like a dame." So flashing back to the 40s. But yeah, he and others along the way comment, You know, you're a child, Rick. You've never grown up. So you really sort of don't want him to be the leader. And I was very delighted that he wasn't, but he also wasn't, not because he didn't choose to, but because Hugh and Mac were left with all the paperwork and the hard job of unifying Mars and cleaning up after the company and all that stuff. And Rick said, "Yeah, I'm still young. I can go to some other worlds and do this all again." Right. So it would just he didn't want to take it over just because it wouldn't have been as much fun. And for some reason, Mayo, who seemed fairly intelligent, is still going to go with him. So. Right. Godspeed to her.
Although right at the end there, she kind of, you know, points a weapon at it and says, "Look, you can't rule Mars."
Right.
And then he decides, well, it sounds like a crap job anyway, so I'm not sure I want to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, up to that point, he did feel sort of entitled to it though, right? Because let's count it off, right? He was captured and put into slave labor, essentially, in the mines. He escaped, led a rebellion, escaped from that, then was, I guess, was sort of ambushed, because that's where Jaffa Storm sent in like the Venusians and, yep. and other folks and, yep. and tried to get them. Yep. They had to find their way out through the Martian mudworm passages and yep. that kind of stuff.
Yep.
Barely survived that. Gets caught anyway, more or less crucified.
Yeah, that was weird.
Sort of. Yeah. And, you know, I was impressed with how grim it was, actually, because I don't always expect that for books of this era.
I agree. However, miraculously, as usual, the knives were very sharp, and so right. they went in between all the tendons and muscles and nerves.
And nerves, yes.
So he was able to recover. About that, that did seem a very interesting, sort of more religious scenario yeah. than I had expected. And at the very end, Lee Brackett mentions once that over someone else who was dying, a childhood memory of a cross came to him, and he made the right. sign of the cross, and then he left. So right. don't know what those two things were, but there they were. Yes, yeah. you're right. He did all the hard work. Then he gets mm-hmm. he got thrown into a pit with hallucinogenic perfume, managed right. to climb out, steal a copter, crash, go yeah. to someplace else, and fix something else.
How did he manage to crawl out of the hallucinogenic perfume? Oh, cigarettes.
Yes, cigarettes. Yes, by burning himself, he managed yeah. to stay focused on what he needed to do. Yes, cigarettes. Yeah. Luckily, they yeah. were there.
Yeah, and it's sort of one of those kind of things. That it reminds me of Kung Fu Panda, where
I loved Kung Fu Panda.
Oogway says one often finds one's destiny on the road one takes to avoid it. And, you know, you have this prophecy that his shadow, I see your shadow over Mars, right? Mm-hmm. And so everybody tries to kill him, and everything they do to kill him makes him more powerful because he comes out of that crucifixion where then Jaffa Storm breaks in with all his people and essentially murders all the high up Martians.
Yeah.
And then Budok gives him the rulership of Mars.
The Collar of Ru. Yes.
Yes. yes. Yeah. Which I thought that city was interesting. The city name is interesting. In German, that means rest.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, or quiet. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, kind of at every turn, he's beset with all these travail or trouble that moves him closer to maybe the man who could rule Mars, right?
Yeah.
It's sort of like the labors of Hercules almost.
Yes, actually, that's a good analogy. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. It is.
He does not slay the Nemean lion, unfortunately.
Yeah, there's so many scenes that there's really sort of no way out scenes that he gets out of. It's really amazing.
Yeah.
I thought that the highlight of the book was that it's a real yarn. It's nonstop action. There were several alien species, good guys and bad guys. And again, those numerous no way out scenes that he does get out of. And I'm picturing that it's absolutely the kind of story that mostly guys, during the golden age of science fiction would have liked, including my dad and all those other guys who were growing up during that era. His collection was fantastic. And he loved them and his friends did. And it's really a nonstop burner.
And one of the other interesting things here is, and I don't know if this is because it's a female author, but you have two female characters who are kind of the only people who are on Rick's side at various points, because he meets the small furry winged Martians.
Yes, Kyra.
And they don't really like him. I guess I looked at it as Kira, but Kyra works too.
Kira, yes,
is the only one that likes him, and sort of planetary romance style immediately falls in love with him.
Immediately, yes.
But
yes.
she says it's because he has such a strong, because he lives so strongly.
Yes, right?
And that's what they need.
Yes, she puts her hand on his chest and says, "Oh, you live so strongly, Rick, you can take over Mars. You can do this." And I'm in love with you. And then he kisses her and she flies away. In the next paragraph, he's kissing Mayo. So whatever. That's fine.
Yeah. I mean, they're fun characters. They are sort of defined by their relationship to a man.
Yes.
But they are also crucial to the story, right?
They
wouldn't move forward the same way.
They both were definitely crucial to the story. Yes.
And I loved too when Jaffa Storm kidnaps Mayo and takes her with him, mm-hmm. and basically says, "Look, you're gonna stay my captive until you submit to me, more or less." But the first thing, he tries to kiss her, and she kicks him right in the berries. And I just thought that was fantastic.
Yeah, that was good. That was good. I appreciated that as well.
Yeah. she was not going quietly.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's it, talking a little bit about the plot, you know, he survives those things and then sort of manages to form an accord between the Martians and the humans that are on Mars to try to overthrow the company. But it's,
yes,
it's a big ask, right? Because they're powerful. And so he goes to St. John and Mac and says, hey, how about this? And they go, yes, that sounds great. We'll back that. Mm-hmm. We want that to happen. And then they immediately double cross him and put him on a ship to get him off of the planet.
I was surprised to see that part. Yeah, betrayal is always a good firm device in an action-packed novel. Yeah. I thought that the way he went about getting the Martians and the Earthmen together, though, was very clever. The first one was going downtown wearing the collar of Rue to the ubiquitous restless mob, which happened to be Martians, and stirring them up and saying, hey, I've got the collar. The company's a bunch of horrible people, and you need to deal with it, and you need to work with the Earthmen. And then he goes to the city's biggest, seediest bar for Earthmen and says the same thing. You've got to work with the Marshies. This is important. We got to kill the company. Better together than not. And so that's great. Yeah, but then he gets double-crossed.
Which, of course, he manages to immediately escape.
Absolutely. Pretty smart, though, the way he did it. I'll give him credit for that.
Yeah. Find somebody who can use 50,000 credits and say, hey, help me get off of here.
And go get the key. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, I did like that, right? I don't even have the key. Like, if I had 50,000 credits, would you have the key? No, but I could get it.
Yes, that was good. But then, of course, they had told slanderous lies about him and everyone recognized him. Oh, you're Rick. And he's running again.
And that immediately gets him into hot water. And now everybody's out for him. And then, so who was the group that captured him and put him in the pit?
I wasn't sure why they were important. This is after his copter crashed in the sand, and he started walking towards the nearest town, but it was this little crummy little town that he had heard about, and some big guys came, and I'm not sure who they were, but they walked him into town, and, you're Rick. We know all about you.
Yeah.
And said some threatening stuff, and then said, throw him in the pit.
Right.
So now he's in the pit. So yeah, I'm not sure who they were and why they were important. It seemed to me like just a sort of another scene that indicate. Yeah, okay, you know how Worf always had to get beat up by an alien only to show how incredibly strong the aliens were, because we all knew Worf was the hero and a big strong Klingon, but. Almost every episode, not almost every episode, I'm sorry, Star Trek.
There are supercuts of Worf getting his butt kicked.
Yeah, so. Exactly. Right. Just to indicate, these guys are really tough. Yeah. I think maybe it was just another scene to indicate that Rick just really had to keep beating the odds. Because otherwise, I can't think of any other tie-in. The copter did not need to crash. It could have kept going and skipped that scene completely. So,
yeah,
just my opinion.
I mean, he's just sort of itinerant. He's going from one place to the next, and finishing the fetch quests, you know, at the various places, and getting his experience points so he can level up and go to the next one.
Right.
To put in gaming terms, and this is where there's the pit with the perfume and the hallucinogenic sort of perfume, right? Where he thinks he sees Mayo, he thinks he sees Kira, and he realizes, oh, okay, this is activating something in my mind. If I go down to the end of this chute, nobody comes back up from that. And of course, no one assumes that he would come back up. And so when he does, everyone's already gone because they think the show is over.
No guards, no button. Yeah.
Yeah. And nobody even monologued. So I like some of the clever things that Rick did. You know, the copter crash, right? He knew that he was being pursued. So he piloted into a sandstorm and then abandoned ship, thinking the copter will keep on going. They'll chase that down. But I'll be gone by then. Or when he crashes his ship into the company headquarters deliberately and kind of erratically, because he realizes, and we haven't talked about this, that Jaffa Storm is telepathic.
Yeah, that was an extra twist, too.
Yeah.
So so then he started singing raunchy ballads to disguise his thoughts, which was great.
Yeah, and that's then you end up with the confrontation essentially at the North Pole, where the thinkers are, and the thinkers have been mentioned, but they're not super well developed. And I'm not totally sure what bracket was going for with them.
I agree. And that was one of my big disappointments. In my line of work, you want to meet the thinkers. I was really looking forward to it. They were mentioned very briefly on like page two. Well, the thinkers are greatly revered on Mars. They live in the North Pole. That was it for until the end. And then you find out they're not really there anymore. Just their bodies and their minds have gone elsewhere and they're all doing their thinker thing. Yeah. I really wanted to meet the thinkers. I've got a bone to pick there. So really all they did was just leave all that dangerous equipment that luckily Jaffa Storm will no longer be able to use since Rick killed him finally. But yeah, that was a disappointment for me. I wanted to meet them. So
yeah, I kind of pictured them. I can't remember what the name of the race is in the John Carter of Mars series where there's like overlords almost. They were more prominent in the John Carter movie than in the book.
That's right. That John Carter movie was in the theaters for what, 4 seconds?
Seems like it was. It was a good movie. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I thought it was really, really good. And it's just, it's not brand new, right? It reminds you a little bit of Star Wars and other things. And so I think it wasn't marketed very well either.
Oh, that's a shame.
So yeah, worth watching.
Okay. Good to know.
I will say that I was watching a YouTube video the other day. It was someone talking about sort of classic science fiction and how lots of times the characters aren't very well developed and, you know, not necessarily the way we would want them. And one reason for that could be that some of these writers may have been on word counts and you have to choose where you're going to spill your ink. But on a sentence by sentence level, there's some lovely prose in this book. I wrote down something from the beginning of one of the early chapters. It says, Phobos had set in the east. Deimos was no more than a red ember low over the desert. The king city of Ru lay silent under the sullen glow, its empty towers open to the wind. The moonlight was like a splashing of old blood on the stones. Just some lovely turns of phrase.
I do remember, but someone commented on that. We were looking for comments about maybe what's unique about the book. I forgot to mention that this was Brackett's first science fiction novel.
Yeah.
She had written westerns and detective stories before, and some commenters said she wasn't a great plotter, especially in her early days, but that it was more of creating an atmosphere and giving you a real sense of place that she was so good at, as that scene you just read. I did feel that uneasy mood with all the enemy factions and the vicious, greedy company and the dark streets and the other things. So that part of her storytelling ability may not have been exactly unique, but it was quite striking, especially in some of the scenes like that you read.
Yeah, you mentioned, this is almost a space Western. You know, there's saloons and there's kind of travel from one place to another, not necessarily on horses, but, and there's shootouts in several places as well.
Yep.
So could fall into that genre.
Yep. Agreed.
Weird Western. I think that's the,
look how great Firefly was.
Yeah.
And all too short lived.
Yep.
But space Westerns can do their thing.
I was a little bummed by the fate of Kyra. Just sort of being wounded off screen and then dying off screen.
Yeah. That was a bummer. I guess there's a possibility that she might come back.
Right. They introduced the reincarnation kind of thing. Yeah.
Right. That was another sort of semi-religious idea. I don't want to say religious, spiritual maybe is a little bit gentler. But that was interesting, but that also, led to Rick's final sentence. When he finally leaves to go off on his other adventures with Mayo, he tells Hugh and Mac before he goes, do a good job running Mars from now on, because if Kyra comes back, I want her to think that my shadow over Mars was still a good one. And that's the last sentence of the book.
Yeah, and that kind of suffices for character development for him, right? Because he, like Mayo said earlier, you don't care about anybody but yourself.
Yeah.
And he has kind of come to.
Yeah. In one of their other big discussions, he finally decides he doesn't want Mars after all. He just wants Mayo and the chance to do the same thing on other worlds, which he says, there are other worlds and I'm young yet. Mayo, I'd rather have you than have Mars. And Mayo says, I said you had a soul if you could ever find it. But I must tell you that my other real low light of the book, in addition to not meeting the thinkers, is that Rick is kind of a jerk.
Oh, yeah.
He only wises up on about the last page of the book in the parts we've just been talking about. And he'd really want to leave all the hard work to Hugh and Mac and go off for more adventures. And I must tell you and your listeners that this novel and the other background info I read confirmed that I never want to date guys like Rick, Eric, John Stark, John Carter, or Tarzan. Just putting it out there.
Yeah. I mean, for me, the stuff that he's gone through has kind of doesn't really redeem him, but it makes me understand why he's a little bit like, hey, I've been through some stuff.
Yeah.
I deserve to get paid now. And then, of course, he realizes what being paid will be, just having to be an administrator of Mars. And that doesn't sound like a lot of fun. So
no, not at all.
Let's go off and have fun somewhere else.
Yeah. So I agree with you. It wasn't that he mellowed, but it's, I agree with what you just said.
Yeah. Do any of these characters recur in Brackett's other work?
I know that Rick does not, because this was mentioned as a non-series person. Okay. Any of the other characters, I'm guessing not, but I don't know for sure.
Okay. Because I get the impression that Brackett kind of had almost a shared universe or like a kind of shared background for her Mars stories.
Well, she had a shared approach, I think, with the similar kinds of heroes, like the John Carter, Eric John Stark type, Rick type of guy.
Yeah.
And they were all sort of underdogs and had something on their conscience or had, you know, something bitter in their past or something. Yeah. So again, not a great plotter, at least in the beginning, but always a sense of creating ambiance and atmosphere and telling a dang good story. At least I could tell from this one.
Mm-hmm. I have not read any other Lee Brackett. So, but based on, like I said, the lovely use of language in the book in spots, I think she's someone that I would go back to. Anything else that you want to talk about this book?
Well, just basically that I'm really glad I was able to dig into not only this particular novel, but learn all about Lee Brackett. She was very fascinating. And as I said before, she was a much bigger influence on science fiction that I'd ever realized. And now I know. So I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is where the retrohelicals can really do something for the fans, right? By highlighting authors that maybe you didn't hear of. And now I can also see the argument that the retrohugos are very subject to survivorship bias, right? Things that have been reprinted are more likely to be remembered. And the things that are remembered then get nominated. And so you're kind of sifting down before anything even gets nominated for retrohugos. And there may have been other things in this year that are now completely forgotten that are great, just it didn't do enough business to stand the test of time.
Could be, but that's the thing. It's all about great stories.
Yeah.
If you run across them, either on Project Gutenberg or someone tells you about them, or you look at a footnote somewhere and you see a name, go and read them, because stories are great.
Yeah. So, you know, before we sign off, where can people find you?
On Twitter, for as long as it survives, I am at Sue the Librarian.
Nice. And that's the primary place where, I mean, that's where we got in contact. So
yes, it is.
Yeah. Cool. Yep. Okay. Well, Sue, thank you so much for doing this. This is really a lot of fun.
Oh, good. I'm glad, because there was a lot of material in there that wasn't primary, like the background stuff. And I wanted to make sure to inject a little humor as well.
Yeah.
And I hope there was enough of it to balance out the fact that your listeners will have to listen to wading through as much as you of that you leave in there. So
yeah. No, I mean, I always appreciate when I can outsource the research part to my guest, which is pretty much what I always do. I do a little bit of reading here and there, and it's one of the criticisms that I get sometimes that I don't do enough. But it's fine.
No, you're doing all the other stuff. No. And again, being an educator means, and a librarian means, I have to find out stuff. So I had massive amounts of notes. The sticky notes alone. Look at the book. I mean, I was serious here.
Yeah.
So that was fun.
Okay. Sue, thank you again. And I'm sure we'll talk down the line.
That would be great. Thank you so much. I've had a great time.
Bye. Well, folks, I hope you enjoyed that discussion with Sue. I thought it was a lot of fun. Like I mentioned, getting right down to the end of the list here, I have two more of these scheduled, and then I will be caught up with the list until the new winner is announced this year. And I am well into my sort of preparation for what to do with the podcast after that time. And I will at some point do an episode talking about that, probably after I actually finish. But something that I did, and I mentioned it at the end of the last bonus episode, is that I created a survey and I put it out on Twitter. It's my pinned tweet on Twitter. So if you have opinions about what I should do with the podcast or opinions about the podcast in general, then check out that survey, click through and send me your feedback, and I will incorporate that into my future plans. By the time this gets, I'm trying to think if by the time this episode gets posted that the Hugo nominees will be announced. So I'm just going to say thank you to anyone who nominated this podcast, because it's too late to ask you to on this podcast. But yeah, thanks if you did. And as always, if you want to support the podcast in any way, you can share the podcast with your friends, retweets, that kind of stuff, on or share on social media. You want to reach out to me, you can do that feedback@hugospodcast.com or find me on Twitter @hugospodcast. And if you want to contribute financially, then you can go to patreon.com/hugospodcast and sign up to support there. And that supports my podcasting here, as well as on Take Me to Your Reader and Brief and Not So Brief. So if you want to do that, great. And if not, also great. Thank you for listening. And I think that'll do it for this time. So thank you so much for listening. I'll talk to you next time. Bye.
The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Kusky.